Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime to seek answers to questions large and small. And, you know, there don't seem to be any small ones anymore. I am delighted to have with me today Dr. Sandra Steingraber, who is a biologist and distinguished scholar in residence at Ithaca College in New York. She has been here to bring her film Unfractured to the Vashon Theater this past Tuesday. And the whole subject is fracking, natural gas, and particularly how Dr. Steingraber has managed to stop fracking in the state of New York. Welcome, Dr. Steingraber.
Thanks for having me.
It's a delight, and thank you so much for taking the time. Tell us, first of all, about the film, Unfractured.
Unfractured is a documentary film that was directed and produced by the award-winning Canadian filmmaker Shanda Chavanas, and I'm the main subject of the film, and it kind of braids three stories together, how we stopped fracking in New York State, how we banished gas storage from Seneca Lake, which is the lake where I live, and how people in Romania stopped fracking. And so I'm a character in all those stories. And even though each of those stories involved a cast of thousands, Shanda wanted to show my transformation from a kind of mild-mannered, shy biologist who mostly likes to look at data into a civil disobedient who went, you know, did got a 15-day sentence and went to jail to try to defend a lake from being turned into part of the infrastructure for fracking, but also how we created a powerful social movement that opened a space for the science to actually win a victory in the state of New York. Fracking was banned in 2014 by our governor on the grounds that that no regulatory framework could make it safe enough for public health, which was an argument that several of us in the scientific community had been making. I feel sure that argument would not have prevailed had we not built out a mass social movement of citizens.
For those of our listeners who don't really know, can you explain to us what the danger to public health is of fracking?
Well, let me take you down into the dark heart of our planet for a minute and just describe how fracking works. Because there's no, underground cameras. We don't have a real visual picture of it. But in many parts of North America, the bedrock is made of shale, and that represents a fossilized ocean floor from 400 million years ago in the Devonian age. And at that time in Earth's history, when there was much less oxygen in the atmosphere than there is now, because there were not a lot of land plants, the water was very oxygen poor. And so when all the sea creatures died and fell to the bottom, they didn't decompose the way they would now. Instead, they turned into bubbles of methane, which is carbon with a few hydrogens around it, or propane, or butane, which is cigarette lighter fluid, or benzene or formaldehyde, or heavier hydrocarbons that we call petroleum. And then they got fossilized actually inside the rock as a kind of tiny bubbles, like champagne bubbles that are trapped inside rock itself. So to get those tiny bubbles out of the bedrock, you actually have to blow it up. And you do that using water as the club to smash the bedrock apart. And also the drill goes down into the shale and then turns sideways, like putting your foot in a cowboy boot, and then is drilled horizontally for a mile or more, actually through the middle of the rock. And then explosives and fresh water is sent down there to blow it up. But that shale is not just a graveyard of prehistoric animals. It is also a living ecosystem. There are organisms that live down there in the shale and feed upon the dead bodies. And so it's a kind of an underground coral reef. And those creatures, archaea is the name of one domain. It's a very ancient microbial life form. They form complex colonies and they can clog up the pipes. So to kill them all off, to allow the gas to flow, very powerful poisons have to be added to fracking fluid. That's why fracking fluid is so toxic. We're conducting a kind of massive subterranean pesticide extermination campaign down there underground. So that is one danger right there, right? We're sending powerful poisons right through the drinking water aquifers that lie between the sunlit surface and the shale layer where all the methane and oil is located.
Wow.
A second danger is that when you drill down into that shale layer, these lightweight hydrocarbons turn into vapor and simply rise and go out of the hole. It takes several weeks to drill a big, long tunnel like that to frack. And during that time, you just basically have an open chimney for these vapors like benzene, which is a carcinogen, like formaldehyde, which is a carcinogen, like methane, which is swings a wrecking ball at our climate. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. Methane is also a precursor to ground-level ozone, also known as smog, which is a killer. It causes stroke, heart attack risk, preterm birth, asthma, and so on. And so all of these vapors come flying out of the hole. It's like each fracking well is like a cigarette in the earth. It's just emitting and emitting. And so air pollution follows fracking wherever it goes. Fracking is also linked to earthquake risk. Fracking also releases radiation and radioactive isotopes like radium and strontium because these underground geological layers contain a whole periodic chart of elements, and these come up with the gas. And so there's no safe way to dispose of all the fracking waste that comes out of the hole. There's no way to make fracking leak-proof. And then finally, when the gas or petroleum reaches the burner tip, wherever that is, then the carbon dioxide so produced by combusting all of these prehistoric corpses goes right up into the atmosphere. And of course, CO2 is another powerful greenhouse gas. So we have climate risks from fracking, and we have direct public health risks.
So, yes, I'm hearing we have air pollution, we have water pollution, we have potential seismic activity, and wasting water, by the way.
Yeah, and terrible health and safety threats to workers. So fracking jobs are killing jobs. They have some of the highest rates of on-the-job fatalities of any other industry. We can measure benzene in the urine of workers on fracking well pad sites that we know is high enough in concentration to cause leukemia. Right. And so as a biologist, I went to work when in the state of New York, we were trying to make the decision whether to prohibit or permit fracking, and to bring out of the peer-reviewed scientific literature all the evidence for the risks and harms of fracking. I did that as a co-founder of a little group called Concerned Health Professionals of New York. We were a group of scientists and physicians. And when we did the first edition of our compendium of all the evidence on the links and of risks and harms of fracking, there were 9 studies in the peer-reviewed literature. Then we did another edition, there were 65, and then 150. And then when we finally banned fracking, there were 400 studies in the peer-reviewed literature. After we banned fracking in New York, lots of other states, including Washington State and Oregon and Maryland and other places that had shale, also began consideration on whether to allow fracking or to ban it. And our compendium played a role in that. Today, we have, we're on the 6th edition of this compendium. There are now more than 1,800 studies in the peer-reviewed literature. So it's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. When you only have 65 studies, you can't see a lot. But now that we have 1,800 pieces of the puzzle, you can really see the evidence for harm.
Let me ask you this. Well, was this knowledge available to our government when they first started allowing energy companies to frack for liquid natural gas?
Well, natural gas is not a liquid. It's a vapor.
Oh, okay.
So it can only turn into a liquid through cryogenics if you bring the temperature down to -260 degrees Fahrenheit and turn it into liquefied natural gas. That's what's being planned for Tacoma, right? So that's a project that just needs to be stopped for health and safety reasons and for climate reasons. But the larger story is that fracking rolled out faster than the science could get done, right? Yeah. The wheels of scientists kind of grind slowly on, and now we have all kinds of evidence showing that there's not only is fracking dangerous, but there is no regulatory framework that can make it safe, because you're actually blowing up the bedrock itself. There's no control over how far the fractures go. There are many abandoned wells that nobody even has mapped that can serve as highways for poisonous fluid that now you've pushed around underground, and it can find an old abandoned well and squirt up to the surface or get into the groundwater. If these things are uncharted, there's no way of modeling the risks or avoiding it. There's no way of avoiding earthquakes and so on. So this is just a problem in public health like lead paint, in which there's no way you can, you know, paint the inside of your house with lead and have it be safe for a child. It just needs to be banned.
Do you have any notion of how many states or how many energy companies are dependent on natural gas for energy?
Well, here's the situation where we're at. So it turns out now that we are deploying renewables at such a rate, and the technology is getting better, that the act of taking natural gas into a pipeline and bringing it to a burner tip in a gas-fired power plant to generate electricity is turning out to be not a good idea, because solar and wind, especially now that we have battery storage, can do it cheaper and better. In other words, renewables can do anything gas can do better in terms of generating electricity. But of course, natural gas is not just used to make electricity. It's also piped into our homes. And that whoosh that you hear that turns your furnace on, that's natural gas. The blue flame that you see on your stove, that's also natural gas. And so turning off and developing alternatives to natural gas for heating and cooling and for cooking our food is another task. Now, I've done that in my own little house in upstate New York. My gas boiler needed replacing anyway, and so I just took the whole furnace out and I've replaced it with electrified heat pumps, which can be run on renewable energy, and replaced my gas stove with electric. And I do this as a single mom who's trying to put two kids through college. There are incentives, and they could be made better, subsidies allowing people to do this. You could pass laws saying that no new building can use gas anymore, that we have to adopt these better technologies that are electrified and then run that electrification on renewables. So that's all in progress, but we're really kind of, when we look at it from a climate perspective, we're really running two races at the same time, right? We have about a decade left before us to decarbonize. And so we need to close the door on more fossil fuel build out. And at the same time, we need to open the door for all this renewable technology that's really being held hostage as long as oil and gas kind of is filling up the stage. So we need to chase out the oil and gas and bring in the renewables. And that's the fight of our lifetime. And of course, right here on Vashon Island, right here in Puget Sound and Tacoma, because this community's fight is about whether or not to build this LNG facility, the stakes couldn't be higher, because the worst form of natural gas is LNG.
Liquid natural gas.
Because just super chilling it to make it that cold so it reaches its condensation point and liquefies requires massive amounts of energy, right? Also, benzene is released because benzene can't contaminate the gas when you liquefy it, because benzene has a freezing point that's higher, and that will it will clog up the lines. And so benzene has to be distilled out of the gas, and it's usually just released into the air, and it becomes a hazardous contaminant then that, you know, is a public safety and health issue. Then when you liquefy this natural gas, you decrease the volume by 600 when it goes from a gas into a liquid. And it's basically highly explosive and just dangerous, right? So there's a huge safety risk that's many exponentially times higher than just natural gas as a vapor. And so this is what you're bringing into this community. And because liquefied natural gas is so capital intensive to set up, the return on investment is about 40 years into the future. If this plant gets built, investors are still expecting to get return on investment four decades from now. That's way past the biological deadline at which we need to be off natural gas. So it's really the moral challenge of this community to stop that plant.
And can you update us as to the current status of that plant? In other words, how far along are they? Is there already liquid natural gas stored
there? Well, here's where I'm going to defer to the real authority in the region, which is the, let me see if I can get the name right, the Vashon Island Climate Action Group.
That's right.
Yeah. So they're the watchdogs of, they're one of the many watchdogs of this, right? And so I just urge everyone to wake up to the issue before you hear. You know, in my, where I lived, the issue has been, will we actually blow up our bedrock to extract natural gas from it? And will we run pipelines across New York to bring that gas to foreign markets? Here in this coastal area of Washington State, the issue is, will we allow this community to be used as a depot for taking natural gas that's fracked somewhere else up in Canada and then be transported across the ocean and keep the fossil fuel party going long after it should have hit curfew? If you feel neutral about this and you don't want to get involved, essentially you're siding with those who say that's what we're going to do. I mean, I feel strongly that every citizen here needs to become aware of this facility and find a way to get involved. There's a lawsuit that's pending. That's great. Law plays a really important role. There is science that shows that this should not be happening. That's great. Science plays a really important role too. But science and law don't work unless there's a powerful uprising of citizens.
You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and my guest is Dr. Sandra Steingraber, who is a biologist and activist from Ithaca, New York, from Ithaca College in New York. And she's here on Vashon to discuss or to display a film called Unfractured about how she and others managed to get a fracking banned in the state of New York. So you're saying, Dr. Steingraber, that law works, science works, they all play a role, but what really works is community action. So tell us what you did in New York, how you went about convincing the state of New York to ban fracking.
Sure. And just to, you know, place this in a larger kind of historical and cultural context, I would argue that that women won the right to vote, and that, you know, that started 30 miles from where I live in Seneca Falls, New York, right? That's where Susan B. Anthony and everyone kicked off their campaign. That took 80 years. Abolitionism, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, Social Security itself, eventually it was decided that policy should align itself with justice. But before that decision was made, it wasn't made by people just gently making the case. It was made because citizens demonstrated the breadth and depth of their opposition to an injustice. So that is how we stopped fracking in New York. We began with the science that showed that it was inherently harmful. And we then built out a movement that involved, we called ourselves New Yorkers Against Fracking. We began as a coalition of four groups and me, a biologist. And by the time we banned fracking, we were more than 400 groups. And those groups included Faith Leaders Against Fracking, which itself was a coalition of 500 churches and synagogues,
wow.
Right? It included artists against fracking, students against fracking, farmers against fracking. And so we just kept building out our movement until it became clear to our governor that his base and his constituents wanted a ban on fracking, and his political career depended on being our champion. And we were ready and willing to let him wear the mantle of climate hero, but we needed a ban on fracking, right?
How did you build that coalition? In other words, how did you convince all those groups that fracking was bad. Did you use logic?
I did, because that's what I do. I'm a biologist. And so my fellow scientists and I spent a better part of 2.5 years going from community to community, focusing on the communities that were going to get fracked first in the southern part of our state, and bringing the science on the health impacts and the climate impacts and also the economic impacts, right? Sex trafficking often comes along with fracking, increased drunk driving rates and drug abuse, increased sexually transmitted diseases. When fracking comes into a community, they bring a whole workforce of young men from somewhere else who often are sleeping in man camps. So there's a whole crime rates go up, and that's there are problems to roads that are of interest to mayors and city council people. And so we had all this data, and what we learned was the more people learned about fracking, the more opposed they were to it. But we learned something else too, which is when you empower people with science, they feel like they have agency over the situation, and they're willing to show up at public hearings and stand up and testify. They're willing to write letters to their governor. They're willing to write letters to the editor and speak about it. So we informed the science with data, but then we inflamed them with a feeling of power. And so in the end, all total, as the years went by where we were still in the decision-making process, we helped direct 250,000 public comments to Albany about fracking. Almost all of those were strongly opposed. So that helped open the door for our governor and our commissioner of health to say, you know what, this is a risk for public health, and no regulatory framework can really mitigate those risks, so we're going to prohibit fracking. So our job wasn't try to convince our elected officials of the science. Our job was to say, all of us are convinced, and we are a mighty force of people.
How much resistance did you get from the powers that be, the lobbyists, I presume, for natural gas?
Oh, you can imagine, right? I mean, yeah. There were actually headlines in my own newspapers that literally said things like, the shale gas army has arrived. Resistance is futile. And they weren't being funny or ironic, right? And so I woke up one morning as a mother who lives in a little village to discover 40% of the land in my county had already been leased to the gas industry, including plots of land at the end of my block. My son had asthma. So I made a decision at that point that whatever skill set and knowledge I possessed as a public health biologist, I was now in a frontline community of my own, and I threw my hat in the ring with those who set out to fight this. And we won, right? We won. And so it's the film Unfractured has a happy ending. At the same time, even though we banned fracking in New York, we didn't ban fracking infrastructure. So then I live between these two lakes, Cayuga and Seneca Lake, which provide source of drinking water for many hundreds of thousands of people. And Seneca Lake, where salt mining has occurred for 100 years, had a whole row of abandoned salt mines that a Houston-based gas company decided to use as free gas tanks to store fracked gas. So it's going to be this massive gas depot on the shores of our lake, not unlike the situation with LNG here in Puget Sound. And then they would store it there and then put it in pipelines. The gas wasn't for us. It was going to be shipped out of state. And so we did a similar process where we brought data and showed the depth and breadth of opposition to the decider. In this case, it was the federal government, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and we lost. So all permits were given. So then I had a second decision to make as a biologist and a mother. Okay, I did the best I could, and we lost. Am I going to stop or not? And we decided to start a civil disobedience campaign. So in other words, if you wouldn't listen to my data, you're going to have to listen to my mother's body standing in your driveway, preventing you from putting that gas in that hole. So we kicked off a civil disobedience campaign in 2014, and it went for almost 3 years. More than almost 700 people were arrested. I did two tours of duty, 15 days each was my sentence in the Chemung County Jail. As did many others. And in the end, the company went away. because I think we made it clear, all of us who were mothers and scientists and healthcare workers and teachers and dental hygienists and farmers who were arrested in this driveway, including a 93-year-old great-grandmother, right, that we could outlast them, that we loved our water and we loved our community more than this company loved its quarterly returns, and we weren't going anywhere. And so we ran a corporate campaign, although we didn't know it. And at the same time we did that, there were other groups that did things like had municipalities sign petitions and got business leaders to object, right? So old-fashioned kind of organizing together with civil disobedience convinced this company that the cost of doing business at our lakeside wasn't worth it for them, so they went away. So that was another kind of victory, much more hard won.
That sounds, the entire effort sounds incredibly difficult.
Well, that's my message for this community, is that if you're going to fight these projects, you have to go all in. You have to fight with your whole heart. And if you do, these things are winnable. I think these companies always come in, the fossil fuel companies in particular, are really good at this, wearing the mantle of inevitability and acting as though there's nothing that you can do. They are big and you are small. They have the ear of your elected officials and you don't. And it can be turned around, but it's a huge fight. But you know what? This climate crisis, when we say it's an existential crisis, we mean it's threatening human existence.
Exactly.
And those of us who are adults at this moment in history, we didn't ask for this, but we're the only generation left that can stop this. So it's a moment that requires heroism. And, you know, my dad had to go off and fight Hitler when he was 18. I think he was a lot more scared than I was fighting the gas industry in New York. So I think about my dad a lot. He suffered from PTSD for the rest of his life based on some of his experiences in Europe. But he considered it a necessary and glorious thing to do. And it was my dad who taught me that when you carry around a name like Steingraber, you can't be a good German, right? You can't turn away from the atrocities of your day. You have to engage in the fight no matter how hard it looks. And so, you know, the message I bring to Vashon is if you fight, you can win. And if you don't fight, you won't win. And fighting means that you know, if you are willing to fight with your whole heart, I think it's inspiring. I think there's power in it, and other people will join you. And on we go.
Dr. Sandra Steingraber, I am so grateful for the time you've given us and for the message that you're bringing to Vashon Island. If you folks did not see the film Unfractured here at the Vashon Theater Tuesday, September 10th, will it be available elsewhere at some point?
At some point. The film is winning awards and still making the film festival circuit, so it's not quite available yet. But I would tell folks to take a look at our compendium where we've accumulated all the data, including on the risks and harms of LNG, which I think might be helpful to this fight. You can just Google fracking compendium and easily find it.
Fracking compendium. Thank you for listening, folks. You've been listening to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every week to seek answers to questions large and small.